Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Today I'm joined by writer Louise O'Neill, whose books Only Ever Yours and Asking for It have been causing quite a stir in the last couple of years. She won the YA Book Prize, the Ellis Dillon Award and an Irish Book Award just this year, and has also been shortlisted for the Waterstones Children's Book Award. I read Only Ever Yours recently and I was caught up very quickly and heavily in this fascinating story about a world in which baby girls are created and raised to grow into one of three very specific roles. It's a frightening, shocking and really smart novel. Louise, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
After all this time, I'm so excited to speak to you. You can't imagine.
Yeah, yes. It's taken us a bit of time, but we're here now.
It's taken me a bit of time, but we are here now. All these really incredible reviews and awards and nominations for your first book in, you know, a world where so many debut novels kind of just vanish pretty fast. I mean, a year and a half later, is it still really exciting?
It is really exciting. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily to do with the merits of the book, because I think incredible, you know, beautifully written novels get released every week and every day. And as you said, so many of them disappear without trace. I do think with this particular book, when I wrote it, I had an appetite for these kind of stories, stories that, you know, were maybe outside of the norm, that were discussing issues like feminism, like misogyny. And I didn't really feel like there were that many books out there that were dealing with these sort of issues. And I thought, well, if I'm hungry for these kind of books, then other people, other readers must be as well. And I think that's the reason why it has struck a chord with people, is because there is an appetite out there for these kind of stories.
Did that add pressure on you, the fact that the first book did so well, when you started writing Asking for It, or had you already begun that and you didn't let it affect you?
I was actually really lucky because I managed to write, I had the first draft of Asking for It completed 2 months before Only Ever Yours came out. So I managed to write both Asking for It and Only Ever Yours in complete seclusion, really. So it was just me and my laptop and the story. And I could tell that story the way that I felt that it needed to be told, and not to get worried about outside influences, or, you know, there wasn't that kind of pressure. I just signed another two book deal with Quercus, and I am feeling a little bit of pressure now for the third novel, because the last year and a half has been such a whirlwind with both books. I couldn't have asked for a better reception. So it does put a little bit more pressure on for the next book.
I'm going to ask about what the next book is a little later, because I do want to know. But this idea of writing for a certain age bracket or a certain genre, I mean, obviously you haven't restricted yourself genre-wise, but I'm guessing that wasn't something that you thought about when you first started writing fiction.
No, I didn't set out to write for young adults. When I started writing Only Ever Yours, I set out to write a book for women, even though I have been surprised by the amount of men who read the book and really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, if the story is good enough and compelling enough, then it, you know, it should resonate with people regardless of gender. But that was very specifically for women. Whereas, and I think the success of Only Ever Yours across all age categories really meant that Quercus, my publisher, decided to republish it as an adult edition in July 2015, a year on from its first publication.
Which is interesting and doesn't happen very often, I believe.
I think they made the decision. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So I was really honoured, and I think it's just such a testimony to the sort of support that Quercus have given me, and how fortunate I have been to have found a publisher that really understood my voice and understood that my books, you know, were never really comfortably sat in either young adult or adult, that they kind of straddled both. So I think when Asking for It, when there was real buzz building up about Asking for It in-house, and they were like, you know, this is going to be one of our big books for autumn, and they were like, this book is for everyone, you know, we're not going to limit ourselves, this book is for people of both genders and of all ages, and I think that's true, because I think that, you know, consent is something that both men and women need to be thinking about, and we need to be having this conversation with both our young women and our young men. And I think the problem is that traditionally rape prevention programs have very much focused upon teaching and educating young women on how to avoid being raped, rather than teaching young men, you know, not to rape. And I think I would be very disappointed if I felt that my novel was once again being targeted only at women, because I think men have to be part of this conversation as well.
Now, I read interviews where you've said your initial thought, the initial image for Only Ever Yours came from a single image of a young girl standing in her underwear before a class, and a woman, a nun, was marking out parts of her body, labelling them as fat, pointing them out as fat. I want to know how much changed in the book between that sort of initial rush of ideas you had in that Starbucks in New York and then the year you actually spent writing it when you were back home in Ireland. I'm guessing there was some time between the two.
There was. I suppose the main change was Frida. You know, I had all these ideas, and I, you know, I had all these, the only way I can describe it is sometimes I think that for me writing a book is like a jigsaw, and there's 100 pieces in the jigsaw and I'll have 60 pieces, and those are images in my head of scenes and of things that I want to include, and then I have to sort of piece them together and figure out what the other pieces of the jigsaw are going to be. And for me, the real point of knowing that this book was going to work was Frida's voice, because I didn't have that in New York. I had all these ideas for this world, and it was Frida, and Frida and Isabel's relationship actually I think is one of the most powerful, for me, one of the most powerful parts of the book, and gives it its emotional heart. I didn't have those ideas in New York. I had the political ideas, I had the concept, but that heart of the novel, you know, the Frida's voice and her relationship with Isabel, that I only developed that when I came home.
And what was the move back home like? You went from a small town in Ireland to New York City, Elle magazine, I assume ridiculously good looking fashion models all around, and then, you know, back to where you'd grown up. Did this have an effect on your writing as well?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I had had a difficult adolescence. I had really struggled with living in a small town, and, you know, that it was, you know, it was, I mean, as an adult, I can appreciate all the wonderful things about living in a small town. But as a teenager, I did feel very stifled. It was a very, you know, white, heteronormative sort of environment, and very much patriarchal, even though I didn't realize it at that time, because I wouldn't have had that vocabulary. And I think, you know, moving away from that, going to Dublin and then moving to New York, I really expected that when I moved back to Clonakilty that I would struggle. And I think that what actually happened was I moved back, it brought up all these old memories, it brought up all these old tensions and all these old wounds. And I had to deal with those. I had to work through those. I had to, you know, learn how to have an adult relationship with my parents, learn how to be an adult within my relationship with my sister. And I think as I was working through all of those issues, it's not surprising that the voice in Only Ever Yours came out as an insecure 16-year-old. But I think the most powerful impact actually moving home had on my writing was it was just the space. You know, New York is this frantic city. The pace of life is so fast, and it just thrives on energy and ambition. And I think I needed that. And then as soon as I came home and the slow pace of life and the quality of stillness and it's just so beautiful in West Cork. And, you know, I went for walks every day on the beach with my dog, and, you know, I took up yoga and I was, you know, outside in nature, and I just felt so peaceful. And really, I think that space, not only physical space, but time and mental space, just allowed all of these ideas to mushroom and just allowed me to create this bubble of silence in which I could write this novel.
So there were parts of Only Ever Yours that I found particularly evocative, effective, you know, frightening, as much of it was, specifically about the girl's eating disorders. Before I knew that you had drawn at some level from your own experiences and your own personal struggles, what I found most frightening was that this was a place, the society in Only Ever Yours, a culture of society, whichever that you call it, that almost encouraged these eating disorders. This was a place where nothing was sacred, not mental or physical health or general balanced sense of well-being, as long as, you know, a girl fit into the mold society said was perfect or just right for her. Mm-hmm. What was really worrying to me, you know, as a woman, as a mother of a daughter, is that, of course, this is very much what our world can be like, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. I was having a conversation with a very good friend of mine today, and we were talking about eating disorders and, you know, eating issues. And she said, I think everyone is affected by this. And I said, I agree. I think it's a spectrum. I think some people have very disordered eating, you know, in the way that I did, so that they have serious, you know, emotional addictive problems in that way. And then I think there's people at the other end of the spectrum who don't have an eating disorder, but who do have hang-ups about, you know, this food is good, this food is bad. You know, if I eat that, I'm going to get fat. Okay, I've got to restrict my food, you know. And I think that's really interesting, because we, none of us lives in a vacuum. We've been brought up in a society in which fat shaming is rampant. Like, there's such a fear of fat. You know, I think that's Adichie is really interesting in Americana, when she's talking about, you know, having come from Nigeria, and she said there fat was a descriptive word, and she said it was only when she moved to America that she realized that fat was an insult, that fat meant, had all these connotations, that it meant, you know, laziness, and, you know, that you were, you know, that you were kind of disgusting, really. And I think that's so harmful, you know, because that's so damaging. And I think that when you're constantly being given that information, especially when you're younger, you're like, okay, in order to be acceptable, in order to be loved, which is all anyone wants, it's like, I have to be thin. And then in order to, you know, remain thin, or to maintain that thin body, sometimes people go to extremes in order to achieve that. And I think that's where eating disorders are born. And I think it has lessened, but I obviously went to an all girls boarding school from the age of 4 to 18, and there was so much discussion about weight, about food, about calories, about diets, about, you know, celebrities, bodies. And it's toxic. It really is toxic, because the more you talk about it, and the more you think about it, and the more you're judging other people's bodies and celebrities' bodies that say, you know, what do the stars really weigh? It's just, it becomes this really obsessive thinking, and that can so easily manifest into disordered eating, and it does for so many girls. And I mean, it does for men as well. I'm just using the female pronoun, because I suppose within the world of Only Ever Yours, you know, that's obviously what's most prevalent.
Right. I also find the economies of the connection to the economy of women's bodies interesting, because it, throughout history, I mean, at some point or the other, you'd notice that when, you know, and especially in countries where there is more poverty, then a larger woman is more attractive. The minute we have more money, it sort of changes, because, oh, you can afford to shun food, you can afford to not, you know, there's a strange connection in that sense. And that kind of told me a little bit about the economy of the world outside the school and Only Ever Yours, that it may have been dystopic, bad things may have happened, may have affected, say, fertility and, you know, the birth of women, or birth of female children. And yet there seems to be some sort of, you know, maintenance of a patriarchal economy at the same time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is intrinsically patriarchal, that world. I mean, you're like, even the ruler is called the father, which to me, because I'm incredibly close with my father. He's probably one of my favorite people in the entire world. And I know when he first read it, he was like, oh, so the villain is called the father. And I was like, no, the father means the patriarchy. Like, it doesn't mean, you know, doesn't mean you.
Yeah.
So obviously it is completely, as I said, inherently patriarchal, and which our world is. I mean, our world is very much set up to promote, to encourage, to support white, straight, cisgender, usually middle class men. And anyone that fails to conform to those criteria is really handicapped. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, and I know my privilege, you know, I know the fact that I am middle class, I am white. I was so lucky that when I decided that I wanted to write this book, that my parents said I could move back into their house and they financially supported me. I know that there's so many other people who probably are 100 times more talented than I am that wouldn't have those opportunities. But I still, so while I'm very aware of my privilege, and I check my privilege, as they say, I still also know that by virtue of being born a woman, that, you know, let's say I'm going to earn on average, if I was in, let's say, in an office job, that I would earn on average like $150,000, I think, dollars less than a male peer who was doing the exact same work. And I think that, you know, while I am aware of the fact that I have privilege in some ways, I also know and feel very angry about and very infuriated about, just because I'm a woman, I suppose I am seen as less than in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And the world outside the school of Only Ever Yours, because the entire story, the entire novel is sort of you know, set entirely indoors inside this one single controlled environment with very limited interaction, or filtered interaction rather, with the outside world. I'd love to know more about the outside world. Did you work out any details for, you know, everywhere that wasn't in the school? Would you go back to that world ever in future books?
It's interesting, I suppose, especially at the moment, because I just sold the movie rights for Only Ever Yours, and they wanted to make a TV series as well. And so there's been a lot of discussion back and forth with the screenwriter and with the movie producer. And, you know, she sends me emails and she's like, okay, what is this? And what does this mean? And what would have happened here? And while I did do a very, like, you know, when I was starting, I did sort of like a history and, you know, where the world, like where these places were located and what the world was like and how, you know, the school was connected to the Eurozone. But I suppose because it's a first person narrative and Frida doesn't have that information,
right,
because she's a woman and because she hasn't been encouraged to think or to question, or to even, you know, wonder about what might be outside the school, I wanted to keep that kind of, I suppose, naive quality quite fresh and quite real. So I didn't go into, you know, a crazy amount of detail. I did have, you know, like I would have sketched just so that I had that very clearly in my mind exactly, you know, where that was or how that had happened. But I didn't, you know, I didn't draw like little maps of like the world outside in that very specific detail.
But that's interesting, because if you've sold the movie rights and the TV rights, which, by the way, congratulations, because that's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Make sure they don't ruin it, please.
I really trust them. As soon as I was speaking with Adrian Becker, the CEO of Killer Content, who bought it, I just knew she would do a great job. She's so dynamic. She really understands the story. She is a feminist. She has a daughter, you know, and I think a 12-year-old daughter. And I trust her, and I'm a very instinctive person. I always go with my instincts, and I really believe that she'll do an amazing job. And obviously a movie and a book are two entirely different entities, and I presume there will have to be changes, and I'm okay with that, you know, as long as the movie is still true to the message of the book.
Yeah, and that's what I think will be interesting, is that, as you're saying, if you didn't draw out little maps, say, for the outside world and the details, in a way it'll be interesting to see how they reproduce, not reproduce, but recreate, say, this story and fill in certain gaps that were left, what their perspective
is. Yeah, I mean, I presume they will, but I mean, I still think, you know, the story is set within the school. And the reason I very much deliberately did that, as I said, because Frida wouldn't have access to that kind of information, but also because I remember my feeling of my 6 years in school was overwhelmingly of claustrophobia, a feeling like I would never escape. And I think that was what I wanted to capture within the environment of the school, this sense that the walls are closing in on Frida, and there is no escape for her.
Yeah. Well, I found that you did so many of the things so well, not just the claustrophobia, but there were so many ideas and concepts in the book that you took what I knew, what we know of the world, and you ripped off this kind of fake glaze, if it had any on it, and you blew it up and you slapped me in the face with it. So it's sharp and it's haunting. And sometimes it's really brutal to read, though, of course, you know, as you know, I loved it. But what was the process of writing it like? Were there parts that were particularly difficult to write because of how brutal they were or how frightening they were?
It's funny, because I thought Only Ever Yours was, you know, I would have said, oh, some parts of it were very difficult to write and very cathartic. And I think Asking For It, my second novel, was just such an incredibly difficult book to write that looking back, Only Ever Yours seems easier, because I think I had fun with it, because there was aspects of it, you know, the girls' names and, you know, I suppose distorting some of the language, and just little, you know, not capitalizing the girls' names, and I think because of all those little small details, that kind of amused me throughout the writing of Only Ever Yours. But Asking For It was just was a harrowing experience to write, is the only way I can describe it, because of the research that needed to be done, because of the way in which I write, which is very immersive and quite obsessive, and I really take on, I think, the qualities of the main character that I'm writing, and because of what Emma was going through, It was a very challenging experience. So looking back, I would say that Only Ever Yours just seemed to flow. It came, I say that it came through me rather than from me, that I, you know, when I was editing it, there was entire sections that I had no recollection of ever writing. And then I think because of that, because it just flowed in comparison, Asking For It was really digging in deep. you know, in a painful, like in a very painful way. I will say that about Asking For It, that it was a painful book to write.
I'm going to come back to Asking For It in a second, but you mentioned capitalizing not capitalizing the girls' names. I had a question in from John Skeet on Twitter, who wanted to ask about capitalizing words in Only Ever Yours. The girls' names, of course, were always in lowercase. Very telling, in a way, of what little regard society had for them as unique individuals or not unique individuals. John asks, did you consider any other interesting capitalization, such as only capitalizing I when the speaker was self-assured? That's a direct quote.
No, I think, I mean, I didn't. I had other ideas for, like, I wanted anytime I used the word man or male pronoun that I put a capital on it. But it actually got kind of confusing after a while. And I said I was just going to do that when it was related to the father, so that he really was nearly like a Jesus-like figure. And I didn't want to get too bogged down in that, because I felt like it had such a strong impact, because it was only, you know, like, it was, the lack of capitalization was only used for the girls' names. And so I wanted to emphasize that, and to make, you know, that it very clear that the reason why they weren't capitalized was because they were so subordinate to men within this society.
They didn't even deserve uppercase names.
Yeah, exactly. And I played around with that as well, which I thought was, which was fun for me, that, you know, the men were all named after politicians and scientists,
right,
and playwrights, and the girls were all named after, you know, models and actresses. And I think what I wanted to explore again was that idea that for girls, you know, that it's usually beauty that's prized, and that for men it tends to be intelligence, success, ambition, achievement, you know, that is seen more as important for men in our culture.
And I wanted to talk about music a little bit with you, because I read somewhere recently how Hole's Doll Parts worked its way into your book. Do you listen to music when you write? I mean, does it help you? Does it distract you? Does it
No,
work
I,
well?
I need complete silence when I need complete silence when I write. I'm obsessive about it. When I write, I move back home to Clonakilty, to my parents' house in West Cork, and they're always out all day. So it's this really big house in the middle of the country, really quiet, and I work with earplugs in. So like that'll tell you, you know, the level of silence that I need. But what I do is I get up really early. I'm always at my desk by about 6:37 a.m. and I write for till about maybe 12, and I always go for a walk after that, and I would listen to music, and I used to listen to Hole a lot, just because I think there was a quality of anger in Courtney Love's lyrics and in her voice that really spoke to me, and I think that anger is very much present in both books, and I think it's a really important element of them. And it was Doll Parts that I listened to on repeat for the first book. And it was just such a coincidence, because I listened to that all the time, and then they came back with the doll cover. And then with the second book, I kept listening to Hole's Asking For It. You know, was she asking for it? Was she asking nice? And it was so eerie, I think, when my editor came back and she was like, oh, we've been thinking about titles, what do you think about Asking For It? And I was like, oh my god, that's so weird. And I was like, okay, that's perfect, you know. And it felt very appropriate.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Asking For It, which is of course about rape culture, it's not a speculative novel, it's not a dystopian novel, it's very much real life, and it's frightening as hell. Even so,
yeah.
How was it switching genres?
It was fine. I think I was so, like, I never wanted to write a trilogy, because I really felt like once I'd finished Only Ever Yours, I was like, I'm done with this story, I'm done with this world, for now anyway. And I didn't want to become one of those authors that's, you know, only works exclusively within one genre, or, you know, because I had people talk to me about that when I was visiting different agents, and one said, you know, we're going to make you a brand, you know, we want, when, you know, like a John Grisham or a Jodi Picoult, so that when someone goes into the airport, that when they see one of your books, they know what they're going to get. And I mean, my God, congratulations to John Grisham and Jodi Picoult, because they're doing amazingly well. And like, I would love to have the kind of sales figures that they enjoy, and, you know, they're brilliant at what they do. But I suppose for me, I just wondered if I would feel creatively stifled if I felt like I had to adhere to a certain formula every time I was writing. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, again, you know, I'm only two books down, so I have no idea what I'll do in the future.
Right.
But I think as a writer, you write the story that comes to you. And these were the two stories that came to me, and these are the two stories that I wanted to write about.
Now, I assume that by now you've spoken to hundreds of young readers with, you know, the bookstores and all the rest of it. What do you say to them about feminism?
It's very exciting when you speak to younger readers, especially like some of them have said in the same way. A teacher gave me a copy of The Handmaid's Tale when I was 15, and that book introduced me to feminism. That book changed my life. So when I have readers of 13 or 14, you know, saying to me that, you know, your book radicalized me, your book made me a feminist, you know, it made me think about these issues, that is just incredible. Like, I just feel so proud and so happy. And then, you know, when they're saying, I never thought about these issues before, and I think it's really important that we talk about these topics, I mean, I couldn't have asked for more. Like, what else as a writer, what else are you dreaming of, except that, you know, you that something that you put out into the world could have this impact on other people?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one last question. What's next? What are you working on next?
If my editor's listening.
You're working really hard, right?
I am, yeah. I am. To be honest, I think because as soon as Only Ever Yours came out and the reaction was just so instantaneous, I've just been so crazy busy with promotion and book festivals and, you know, just trying to kind of keep on top of everything. And I'm traveling so much. And I just signed another two book deal with Quercus, because I have an incredibly close relationship with my editor, Niamh Mulvey, and she's just one of the most fabulous people and also just so superb at what she does that I really wanted to keep working with her. But I'll be on their adult list. So the next two books are going to be adult, even though I can't see there's going to be much difference, to be honest, in my writing style. I'm going to move home. I'm living in Dublin at the moment, and I'm thinking the West Cork is calling me. I'm going to move back home in January and start writing again.
So, of course, you're not going to say what the next books are about. We're just going to have to guess.
I can't. You're going to have to wait.
Are they connected? Can I ask that, the next two books? Are you looking at standalone
stuff? Do you know what? No, I'm really at the moment, I'm exploring ideas. I'm looking forward to getting back to that space, to that quiet, and just shutting out the outside world for a while.
Well, I'm looking forward to what you come up with next.
Thank you so much.
It's going to be exciting. Kind of you. And hopefully we'll speak again when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Louise. It was absolutely lovely speaking to you today.
It was lovely speaking to you as well. Thank you.